Good afternoon, good night, wherever you are in the world. I'm going to give us a few minutes because people are coming in and we'll let everyone get. Hello, hello. So good to be with you all. I'm super excited for today for sharing this information with you. And let me just start with housekeeping. People are still coming in. And I just want to let you know that tomorrow we'll have this replay up on that special page you have. I think we'll try and email everybody that link, but it will also be in the Zoom email that you get. And you'll be able to download this and keep it forever and also download the PowerPoint. So, all right. Where are we? So I'm going to start, and I just want to welcome you all to this mini masterclass. And we'll be focusing on menopause, but just to say that the issues that we're talking about are also relevant to male health as well. So I'll kind of let you know when we're talking about that. And I think the sort of unofficial title, we're talking about menopause, is Things I Wish I'd Known Earlier, Volume 1000, and therefore things that I really want you to know. And my intention today is to kind of surprise and hopefully delight you with research that I feel is important and even actually urgent, in the sense that we're talking about areas that are left really unattended in healthcare, particularly healthcare for women and those who identify as women and also trans men. And because of that, and because of some issues with some of the research in 2002, there's been a 20-year, like over two-decade gap in medical care in the menopause field. I'm going to write about that for the next Substack that's coming up and kind of give us, I think, a sense of what has been happening in the background and why so many of us are at a really visceral level that's maybe hard to articulate, often afraid of menopausal hormone therapy, what used to be called hormone replacement therapy. So, getting back to today, some of the studies that we're looking at today, and I think in the field in general, because there's just a tidal wave of new science coming out, they remind me of neurons in the sense that they touch without actually touching. So, today we'll look at neurobiology and psychology of a couple of the different systems involved in menopause and how these systems have this really extraordinary kind of crosstalk. It's really this mind-body network that I've been writing about, speaking about, teaching about since I think 2006, 2007. So, in normally, when I teach, we'll go through a kind of exercise. And today, in order to kind of save time to really go through these studies in detail, I'm going to kind of show you what I would recommend that you do, which I think is actually going to be more productive for you in general. So we'll do that in just a moment. And again, if you're joining us and you're male, I know there are some of you want to be thinking about some of these issues in relation to your own body and then the body of your loved ones, what you've noticed with them, what they've shared with you. And as we're beginning, I just wanted to highlight that there's such a kind of stigma still around menopause that it's not even often addressed in intimate relationships. So I was sharing some of this information with a close relative the other day, and he seemed really uncomfortable. And I said, "Well, is your wife?" I named her, of course. I won't do that here, but is she going through menopause? And he said, "I don't know." But he seemed like he wanted to get off the phone as soon as possible. And I said, well, have you talked about it? Does she still get her periods? What's going on? And he said, I have no idea. And he seemed almost kind of taken aback by the questions themselves. And I think there's a lot that we can do to make these conversations normalized and even welcome in this field, in the care field. So I hope that makes sense to you. I hope that you're talking about this with your partners, male, female, trans, and really just in a very matter-of-fact way. It's a bodily issue, just like anything else that we would talk about with loved ones. And if you have sisters, moms, cousins, etc. So I am going to screen share with you. I'm hoping my intention is to leave time at the end for at least a couple of questions. We'll see how that goes. And I'm going to share my screen with you now. And we will. Oops. So we'll look at a couple of the systems impacting perimenopause, but instead of dropping directly into those systems, I wanted to give you a context in which to put them. So each year, we know that over 47 million people worldwide enter menopause. And by the year 2030, that number is supposed to reach 1.2 billion people, which is really a tremendous number. And I think what we also know from that, because the technical identification of menopause is actually a moment in time rather than a time period. And that moment is the moment at which you've gone for 12 months without having a period, which is actually a really strange definition for me because that moment doesn't necessarily match up with ovarian insufficiency, with the moment at which the ovaries stop making eggs or are making far fewer eggs. So I hope that in the future, that definition of the time of menopause changes. So technically, whatever day it is that you realize it's been 12 months without a period, if you mark that on your calendar, you're already a year past the definition of menopause and you're in postmenopause. So it's really either perimenopause or postmenopause, but menopause is a term that people use for the entirety of that. Oh, that should be perimenopause. I apologize. I'm going to fix that. So typically the number of people that are entering this perimenopause transition is much higher because it's not that one moment in time, that 47 million people. It's everybody typically between the ages of 35 and 45, but also possibly younger, possibly a tad bit older. And what really is of deep concern to me and was my own experience is that more than half of all women or people globally that are entering perimenopause were completely unaware of what the symptoms are or what to look for. And therefore, they were unprepared as to what to look for, what to do, who to see, and they were caught completely by surprise. And one analogy that I thought of as I was preparing to share this information with you is, can you imagine if we identified cancer as stage four only? And then kind of let people know then that they had cancer. And I mean not to compare menopause to cancer. That's not the analogy I'm searching for, but this idea that you're identifying and treating a vast number of people in the end stage of something for maybe a select few symptoms, typically vasomotor symptoms like hot flushes or night sweats. That is typically what the menopause field is focusing on. And yet, there are all these other areas that I'd like to share with you. And I will say, and the reason that I'm writing so much about this, speaking about it, teaching about it, offering tools, is because right now it's really up to us individually and in communities to be able to identify perimenopause and advocate for ourselves. That's just where we are in the field. So, what are we looking for? And this is not the kind of cool studies I wanted to show you, but I felt like it would be really important to just give you a sense of all the different systems involved in perimenopause, and also, of course, postmenopause, in addition to hot flashes, or rather vasomotor symptoms. So I've made you this graph. I hope it makes sense. So you have this kind of major catalyst, which is the loss of estrogen, but also progesterone and also testosterone. Those are kind of the minor players in this trio, estrogen being the kind of solo violinist. So, we have the enteric nervous system, which is our belly brain or our gut brain. And right away, by definition, we know that we're not just talking about our gastrointestinal system, which is sometimes how people refer to it, but we're talking about a system that has this extraordinary crosstalk with the brain, the gut-brain axis, but also with the immune system. And as we'll see with a lot of these, pretty much every other system there is. So, one of the symptoms here is reduced diversity in the gut microbiome. And of course, we don't really have a kind of awareness of our own microbial diversity, but we are likely to notice the other symptoms like the low motility, which is movements of food kind of through the digestive system. We might have acid reflux that suddenly appears when we didn't before. We might have irritable bowel syndrome or IBS, food allergies that are new. And intestinal permeability. I've written about that, and let me make a note to myself to link to that article, so that I can have that in this handout. It'll be right in the PowerPoint, and you can just click on it. And then increased inflammation after eating—that's one of the areas that can come up, and also. There are sometimes swallowing issues or issues kind of related to this system that are seem unrelated or are harder to identify. Then we have our immune system, and of course, these two systems are really intimately connected. And what you might start to see in the perimenopause transition are increased allergies, not just food allergies, but seasonal allergies and allergies to chemicals. And then one thing I hear so much from women, and something I experience myself, is this conviction that there's an autoimmune process happening. I was really convinced I had rheumatoid arthritis. In this transition, it just seemed like all the symptoms were there. And that's part of the perimenopause transition. And then also inflammation, global inflammation through all the body systems, other forms of allergies. Asthma can either worsen or it can kind of suddenly appear. Fibromyalgia, which is thought to be partly an inflammatory illness, and then a lowered resistance to pathogens like viruses and bacteria. I mentioned multiple chemical sensitivities or MCS, and even COVID comes into play here. So, in the menopause transition, research shows that we have an increased tendency to, in response to a pathogen like a virus, to have that sort of inflammatory cascade, that super cascade that happened in the COVID reactions. And I suspect that the number of people that experience long COVID, that's also been connected here to changes at perimenopause. I suspect that there's going to be more and more studies on that relationship. And then we have this kind of neural and cognitive area of functioning. And brain fog is a really, really common issue. But there's also issues with memory, including working memory. And working memory means just I have an idea, I'm going maybe to another room, and by the time I get there, I don't remember why I went, and I can't remember the idea I had when I was going. And on Substack, I have an article also about ADHD. I'll make a note to link that for you. And then, so ADHD symptoms can either worsen or show up when they weren't there before. And then executive function, like planning and execution and understanding the sequence of things we have to do to get from one place to the next. And then there's also often a drop in motivation, which is related to dopamine and ADHD. There's often a kind of bottoming out of what I call, and you won't really find this in the field yet, but a global sense of desire, which is a kind of excitement about our work and what we're doing, which can really disappear, a kind of creative spark that's missing. And often in perimenopause, desire is conflated to kind of libido, and that's all that's really asked about. But I think a global sense of desire is important. And then you get issues with vestibular function, which is balance issues. Along with that, there can be like Meniere's disease, which is a kind of part of the vertigo family and everything related to that. And I think this is really important because these symptoms are often dismissed by doctors as not being related to ADHD, which is why I've spent a lot of time writing about them, because it's so important to kind of, I think, to challenge that really limited notion. Part of the reason why I talk about this a lot too is because many of you that are in my community are solopreneurs. You have your own businesses, and there can be, you can really take a hit to your business in this point in time if you have this kind of lack of motivation, lack of global desire, almost a sense that you're fading out, that your intellect is gone, your kind of, again, that creative spark is gone, and executive function is gone. So it makes it really hard to both adapt to a changing world, or if you will, market around you, and also just to follow the kind of rhythm and the flow of your own creative ideas. Then I just wrote about this for Substack, but the musculoskeletal system, and that can include musculoskeletal pain, joint pain, frozen shoulder, fascial pain, so pain in our connective tissue, loss of lean muscle mass, which is really important. I think I'm going to do a master class just on that, because muscle is a kind of major influencer of emotional health and endocrine function. And then there's also a loss of bone density. And along with that, when you have a loss of muscle mass, there's often a lowering of proprioception, which is the awareness we have of our movement and our movement through space and how we take up space. And also posture can really change as well. And all these things are connected. And then there's also the genitourinary system. And this, you know, talk about stigma in menopause. This is an area that's really often not addressed at all, and it's really important, as we'll see in a moment. And it can include vaginal atrophy, which is a shrinking of actual tissue, vaginal dryness, vulvar pain, pain in the vulva vestibule, pain during sex, a lower libido or interest in sex, and then a lot of symptoms related to functioning of the bladder. So bladder atrophy, so the bladder itself can, what's the word I'm thinking of, harden or calcify. You can have a narrowing or a stenosis or hardening of the bladder neck itself. And that can lead to issues with voiding and not fully voiding one's bladder when you go to the bathroom in a kind of constant urinary urgency, a pressure on the bladder. Both UTIs, urinary tract infections, which are really serious, and then also the sense that you're having a urinary tract infections without kind of clinical levels of bacteria. One thing that I'm going to cover this Saturday is how to kind of keep an eye on, keep tabs on, and monitor the pH of the vagina and the bladder. And then dysuria, which is pain during urination. And again, as I've said, voiding issues, not voiding all the way. And then I just want to highlight here too that this is related to the nervous system. Sometimes the nerves become hyperactive. And then if we look at our limbic system or our kind of the emotional regions of our brain, we often at menopause, one of the hallmarks of perimenopause is increased anxiety, an uptick in panic attacks, increased depression. That one is can be problematic because often if you present with menopause symptoms, you'll just be given an antidepressant, which is kind of a way of maybe it's a word I'm thinking about, managing affect without addressing the underlying cause. And again, here you see low motivation, very low self-regard. So the self-to-self relationship can become kind of altered and a little less compassionate. And then the self-to-body relationship, understandably as well, an uptick in PTSD, and here a lowered sense of agency, which is the ability to have an intention and to kind of create the actions that carry that intention out. And that sort of relates to some of the neurocognitive issues that I mentioned before. And then we have our whole system of sleep and fragmented sleep. So waking up frequently during the night, particularly in the middle of dreams or REM sleep. There can be sleep disorders appearing here, like sleep apnea, which is related also to asthma, but also the structures of the throat and the tongue. It can take a long time to fall asleep, which is sleep onset latency. And then early morning awakenings is a big one. So waking up at 4 or 5 or long before the alarm clock goes off. And then daytime sleepiness, which can really interfere with driving, with work, with, I mean, daytime sleepiness also has an influence on, you know, metabolism, on what we eat and how we digest. So sleep will directly influence the gut microbiome and the immune system, neurocognition. All of these other systems are impacted by sleep. Why am I giving you all this information when it's not really the cool studies? It's together, if you're able to really monitor what's happening here, you can be a much more effective advocate for yourself. You may have to kiss a few menopause specialist frogs in order to find your princess that's open to treatment and maybe more importantly, knowledgeable about treatment. So here, I just wanted to operationalize the graph that we just saw. So some of the questions you could ask yourself, a way to kind of get a baseline, monitor, take notes, have something to go into your appointment with a specialist, because this field, I mean, the specialists that are good have full practices. You will sometimes wait a year or longer. So to be organized and knowledgeable when you go in makes it far more likely that you'll get what you need. So here, it's not something I mentioned earlier, but this sense of being able to inhabit our bodies, sometimes there's a kind of distance, a kind of dissociation that happens, an inability to kind of touch in with different systems. And that's what I often refer to as interoception. And that really changes as we get older anyway, often. But that can be one of the things that makes it hard to look at all these other areas. And then, kind of, what is the approach or the tone or the felt sense with which we're entering the field of our body? I do feel that the stigma still kind of remaining in the field about menopause influences this. I've talked about kind of patriarchy influencing this. We see the kind of rise in the way patriarchy kind of takes over our body sovereignty, even our health care, and how that's much worse for women of color. So, kind of looking at how does that influence our relationship with our body? It's hard to not be influenced by that. And it's good to be aware that that's a social antecedent to the menopause experience itself. And then looking at the gut here, is there inflammation or pain? I will often massage my gut with the palms of my hands. I might lay over a kind of hollow, puffy rubber ball. And that's often when I notice, oh, there's a lot of tension, a lot of connective tissue tightness. In the tissue in my abdomen. And so that can kind of tell me that something is awry with digestion because fascia and digestion are connected. And then, do I have abdominal distension? Is there swelling? Is there constipation? Is there what's called postprandial fatigue, which is the fatigue you get after eating where you just want to fall asleep and it's hard to stay awake? Is there a bumping up in acid, food allergies, all the things that I mentioned before, which you can add in here? And then, what about the immune system? Are you finding autoimmune things happening? Allergies are part of that. Arthritis is part of that, both osteo and rheumatoid arthritis. Are you noticing that your immune system is responding to foods differently? And this becomes really important. I mentioned this in the musculoskeletal system of menopause, but the drop in estrogen promotes an increase in circulating inflammatory molecules like the interleukin-6, interleukin-1 and 2, tumor necrosis factor, C-reactive protein, and those have systemic effects, including in the gut. And then if I'm feeling that, because our immune system and our nervous system are bound together, it's actually called the neuroimmune system now. Am I noticing anxiety in response? Some of you have probably noticed that when you're having allergies, your immune system or your nervous system becomes a little more vigilant. So it's natural for that to happen. So you may notice a lot of mental reactivity, a lot of nervous system kind of overdrive occurring. And that in turn primes inflammation. It's neuroinflammation. And then what's happening in those neurocognitive areas? How is my attention? How is my working memory and long and short-term memory? What's happening with brain fog? What's happening with ADHD? And then looking at, again, this level of motivation. What is my sense of global desire, the kind of spark and the quickening we have in response to our work and our kind of creative process? Think that's really important. And then joint comfort and connective tissue comfort that can change. That's the musculoskeletal system involved in menopause. And then are there issues with bones, or is there a change in my sense of my muscle mass or my strength? I go into this in detail in the Substack, which of course is free. Bone density changes are usually silent unless you get a fracture. So those changes are inaugurated years before. Often people are recommended to get a DEXA scan. I really believe that DEXA scans should be gotten a lot earlier than healthcare is now recommending them, especially given what we know about perimenopause. And a DEXA scan can, certain ones can also get a picture of your muscle mass. And then if you do strength training, you may notice changes in your strength, in what you can lift, or in kind of soreness afterward. And what you might also notice, this is a little more subtle, is that after working out, because exercise creates a tiny temporary bump in inflammation, but if you have a workout that you've often done before, and you feel like taking a nap for 3 hours, that's a key indicator to pay attention to. And then, what is the health of my vaginal tissue? Do I feel discomfort? Do I feel pain? Is there a change in discharge? Is there a change in libido or interest in sex? Or lubrication is another one that's looked at here. And then that can go along with changes in the urethra and the bladder, as I said before. Those are so important to pay attention to and to practice talking with your doctor about. They highlight something I'll talk about in a moment, which is the genitourinary syndrome of menopause. And that is a progressive illness that can be reversed with treatment. So that can manifest in an urgency to pee, in a pressure on the bladder. Again, the sense of having a urinary tract infection without a clinical level of bacteria, waking up frequently in the night to pee, and that can interfere a lot with sleep. And then looking directly at the quality and quantity of sleep in all the areas I mentioned in the previous slide. And then this is really key. What is the arousal level of my nervous system? Do I notice that it's kind of spinning at a much kind of faster rate? Am I vigilant? Am I reactive to kind of, stimuli in the environment, like sound or noise, or am I responding to my children differently when they need something, or to a partner differently when they need something, or even just a short fuse with clients, which can happen? And then is there a kind of resurgence of PTSD symptoms? And then, what about mobility? I'm going to talk about this on Saturday, and I've researched it for my book, but there is this notion that aging causes a loss of muscle mass, and then that sort of creates mobility issues. But Provocative new research indicates something that I've believed and talked about with you all for a while, which is it's not the muscle mass per se, but that the lack of movement in response to reduced muscle can actually cause what the kind of syndromes that we label as aging. So it's the reverse. And that means that mobility, balance training, novel movement can all actually impact the process of agency and aging, both. So these are some of the areas that you can be mapping out. I think I'm going to make a handout so that you can track these things over time and see the changes. And that's really important because if you do any interventions in these areas, you will be the person responsible for noting what's working and what's not. Okay. I know that's a lot of information very quickly, so let's take a little breath together and maybe close our eyes and just feel our bodies. You can even place your hands on your body, maybe one palm on the heart, one on the abdomen. I'm just taking a few breaths to have almost like a digestive interlude. And now I kind of would like to shine the spotlight on PTSD in perimenopause, not from the perspective just that it can increase, but the influence of PTSD on perimenopause. I know that a lot of you have survived physical or sexual trauma in your past. Many women and men have. Those numbers are just incredibly high, as we know. Higher for women of color. And there is finally research on this, some of it pretty new and unique. So I'm going to lay that out for you, and I hope it will be illuminating. So, what the research is saying is that there is a reciprocal relationship between PTSD, inflammation, and perimenopause. A history of PTSD will influence inflammation and perimenopause. And of course, as we've already acknowledged, inflammation and perimenopause can kind of catalyze or exacerbate PTSD. But this to me is really an electric finding, which is that survivors of physical and sexual abuse and assault often enter perimenopause earlier. And typically, up to 20 to 24 months earlier, that is a deeply significant difference. That means, for example, if 35 to 45 is the area, you can, if you are a survivor of these forms of abuse, you can enter perimenopause as early as 32, 33. And why that's significant is that if you go to most doctors with perimenopause symptoms, they will tell you that it's too early to have those. And I've hyperlinked these articles and made sure that you can access them publicly. Lots of them are behind paywalls. Because I think it's really important that you may have to educate providers on this. In the process of advocating for yourself to get treatment, many survivors experience, and this has been known for a while, increased levels of inflammatory cytokines, which are just molecules like the interleukins, tumor necrosis factor, C-reactive protein. Many also have already increased sleep disturbance. And of course, those are related. Inflammation will affect sleep and lead to fragmented sleep. And if there's fragmented sleep, the parts of the brain, particularly in the first half of the night, that kind of clean the brain of inflammatory molecules don't function as effectively. So if it takes you longer to get to sleep, or you wake up a lot in the first part of the night, that's what's happening. That part of the brain is actually known as the glymphatic system with a G, much like the lymphatic system. It's our cl natural cleansing system. And we don't have time today to talk about interventions, but there's some interesting new studies. I'm not sure yet how to interpret them, so I'm going to be careful in the way I state this, but there's some indication that in menopause, melatonin can help, especially with this first part of the night. And also the melatonin kind of synthesis field, the field that's kind of pharmaceuticals that sell this, or nutraceutical companies, there's so much dysregulation that it's really hard to know how much you're getting. And that's a big concern so far. But there are actually medications for this. And that's something I'll go over in more depth in the menopause lab coming up. Increased anxiety and panic attacks, again, as I've said, and the severity of PTSD symptoms. And then what's also known is that many survivors of physical and sexual abuse experience an increase in vasomotor symptoms, like the hot flashes or flushes, night sweats, heart palpitations sometimes. And this, I think, is if there's one thing you take away from this, it's not just a study, but as you'll see, it's a few studies that I'm synthesizing for you, is that survivors also have an increase in the genitourinary syndrome of menopause. And this syndrome, although it's recognized by well-trained menopause specialists, is not recognized other than that. So if you're experiencing bladder symptoms, for example, you can go to urologist, you can get really expensive tests that don't really show anything. And there is well-researched treatment for this that's not being given. And so, if survivors have a capacity to have a more severe form of this, treatment is really important. This is something we won't go into in depth today, but I will say that the treatment is vaginal estrogen treatment, which is completely safe. Vaginal estrogen has virtually no systemic effects on circulating levels of estrogen elsewhere in the body. And it's sh been shown to improve both the vaginal symptoms and the urological symptoms. Really significant. But the caveat is that, and this is something I learned through talking with a lot of other people, is that doctors will seldom either treat this or take the time to explain in detail how to treat it, or to even give an exam of this area and then follow-up exams. So if they do treat it, they tend to just give it a prescription and say, take this twice a week. But the techniques of application of the creams are really important. Sometimes they're in suppository forms. And because they're so effective, it's really important to know how exactly to use them. I'm actually going to go over that on Saturday in excruciating detail with diagrams, because I don't feel that most people get this. I never got this. I had a lot of urological tests with that were completely normal, including pelvic floor tests. As a yogi, we do a lot of pelvic floor training. So by the time symptoms show up, there's already atrophy. But What's really encouraging to share with you is that the creams and the suppositories, sometimes other treatments as well, can reverse the atrophy, the shrinkage of the tissue. How empowering is that? I mean, it's absolutely amazing. But we're still in a place, kind of societally, where doctors aren't really. Unless they're in specialty boutique practices, which often do not take insurance, they're not to do exams, follow up the exams after 3 months of treatment, explain to you how exactly to use the products. That's something that we have to do for ourselves. And again, the fact that this is increased in severity in survivors is really significant. Early intervention for survivors is important. This particular study, and both will be linked underneath, as you'll see, was a systematic review of 21 studies of the impact of trauma on what's called reproductive aging, in other words, perimenopause and menopause. And they found that there, again, is that reciprocal relationship. PTSD worsens menopause symptoms, and then menopause symptoms exacerbate PTSD quite often. Also, having a trauma history is associated with lower results in tests of cognitive functioning that are well-established objective tests. I'm mentioning this because cognitive functioning issues like brain fog, even some of the kind of, I'll just say, famous menopause researchers out there will say there's absolutely no connection between estrogen cognitive functioning or perimenopause and cognitive functioning. But I have actually detailed that connection in the ADHD article that I'll link you to. So it absolutely is there. I'm not sure. I just heard on a podcast yesterday, a researcher from Australia say that nothing's been proven. And I'm not really sure. She is really well known, has published a lot of studies, and I just don't get why that's not being acknowledged and spoken about. Then also we know that PTSD and survivorship is associated with a history of gut inflammation and gut disorders, which we know influence the brain. Microbes can cross into the bloodstream and then move through the blood-brain barrier into the brain. I've talked about that before. I think I'll maybe link to that article too. I don't want to give you too much to read that's overwhelming, but just in case you're a science geek like I am, as I push up my glasses. And then this to me was like a big neon sign. So 20%, which is a vast amount of survivors of abuse and assault, experience something called primary ovarian insufficiency. And if you just Google primary ovarian insufficiency, Arnold 2024, you'll get to that article. Maybe I'll just link that. Glad I have my trusty little pad. Please forgive the pause here. And so you won't hear this, I don't think, from anyone other than me. I've tried and tried and tried to find the proof of this. But what I have found is that people that have experienced both historical trauma, like systemic racism, epigenetic trauma, and present life trauma, can often be less responsive to menopausal hormone therapy. So lower doses are less effective. They still have symptoms remaining, and they may need to be on a higher dose. Primary ovarian insufficiency means that By the time you're in your 30s, your ovaries are making fewer eggs. You have fewer, like a lower circulating estrogen. And sometimes that can be due to the way estrogen cell receptors process circulating estrogen. So I have a feeling that we're going to see this coming out in the research in 5 years, but I'm telling you now because survivorship is really close to my heart as a survivor myself, and I have experienced needing to go up in dose. And also for certain people that have genetic permutations, as my family does, for neurodegenerative issues, that are associated with primary ovarian insufficiency. I'm also convinced there, and it's not, again, it's not in the research, that we may be less responsive to estrogen treatment. So here are the two studies, just to highlight to you that they're hyperlinked in case you want to read them yourself, but all of the studies have been distilled here. So that means we really need trauma-informed menopause care. And yet, I have never encountered, and I had to do a lot of shopping, a menopause quote unquote specialist that even asked about a trauma history. So you will need to be able to mention this. And this is why I include the hyperlinks, because you may have to educate your providers, as I have had to. I'm often going into the patient portals and sending articles to my providers in order to get them to increase my dose or to make referrals to other disciplines. And I think in part when they see that, they realize this person has done their homework. I don't have time to fight this. And there's also kind of a hint of a liability issue if you've given them the information and they're still saying no. I have linked to you really evidence-based research in major medical journals. So that also carries some weight. Let's take another little pause for a breath. I'm going to do a quick time check. Okay. We may, just to let you know, we may go a little bit over, but feel free to pop off if you need to. So, the last kind of few studies I want to share with you focus on menopause and the gut microbiome, but in two respects. So it's kind of a duet of studies and study synthesis. Again, every time we talk about the gut microbiome, we're also talking about a nervous system that's independent of the central nervous system. It produces hormones, it synthesize, it has, as we'll see, an influence on estrogen. Estrogen influences it. So, really exciting and new. So, what is the role of gut microbiome and microbiota in menopause issues? Gut dysbiosis, which is an imbalance in the microbiome, a kind of diversity issue there, is involved in a ton of female reproductive and endocrine diseases. That's already known, like endometriosis, polycystic ovarian syndrome, are already related to estrogen. Gut microbes play a role in the metabolism of estrogen in the bloodstream, which is really kind of wild to me. They secrete a particular enzyme, beta glucuronidase, that actually transmutes estrogen into its active forms that can be kind of processed by the cells. There is a huge difference in the gut microbiome of a premenopausal woman and a postmenopausal woman. And just to highlight that, that means that even in perimenopause, we're having a decrease in diversity already. And that is part of what leads to symptoms that are called gastrointestinal. Endometriosis is an example of an estrogen-dependent chronic inflammatory disease. And people with endometriosis are thought to have a larger number of bacteria that produce this enzyme that moves estrogen into an active form. And that results in kind of an excess of estrogen. So sometimes the thinking is that in perimenopause, you might not want to treat someone until the endometriosis is addressed. But also, this research shows that you can address endometriosis by changing the diversity of the gut microbiome. So this particular study looked at 77 menopausal women and 24 what they call healthy control participants. And they found that 14 different microbe species differed significantly between women who had what they called menopausal syndrome, which just means symptoms, and those who did not, that were sailing along at the same age just fine. Of course, they make these really complex names for the bacteria, but Agrigentobacter saguinis, Bifidobacterium animalis, Acinetobacter guaiae, were all enriched in those women that were transitioning through menopause without symptoms. And these same microbes were related to the estradiol receptor. Estrogen receptor known as E2, which is the most powerful kind of bioavailable metabolite of all the estrogens. Bifidobacterium animalis is a probiotic that has also been shown to improve abdominal obesity, the regulation of blood sugar, which goes awry at menopause, inflammation, which goes awry, oxidative stress, etc. in women with metabolic syndrome. So there's a connection there already. And the others that are mentioned here are correlated with inflammation as well. Here is the study in case you would like to link to it. But there's another reason why I wanted to focus on the gut microbiome with you today. We know about the gut-brain axis, which is that what's happening in the gut affects the brain and vice versa. We know that there's a gut-lung axis. We also know, and I'm going to go into this in greater depth on Saturday, that the gut microbes influence the vaginal microbiome, which in turn influences the urethral microbiome. They're right next to each other, the vagina and the urethra, they're so close together. So, addressing the gut microbiome is one way also to change the genitourinary syndrome of menopause that I mentioned before. But now I want to introduce something that really excited me and I'm happy to share with you, which is the gut bone axis. Okay. So let's take a quick look. Gut microbes influence bone metabolism, which I just addressed in the most recent Substack. We have a microbiota bone axis, which is really wild to me because it wasn't necessarily true that those things were known to be connected. It's pretty new. In fact, one of the articles I'm citing here is dated December of 2024. So it's an early publication. And they found that, and I just want to say, bone health and estrogen are also really important to men and trans people. So men have fractures as well. Men need estrogen as well, just as women need testosterone. So if you know men that are important to you, or that you teach or work with, this is something you can share with them, that the microbe and the microbiome affects bone formation and homeostasis. So bone homeostasis is just the balance between the formation of new bone and the resorption or breakdown of old bone. And what happens at menopause is that you get less formation of new bone. You get very slow repair of damage to bone tissue, and you also get increased resorption of bone. So it sends things out of whack, and that leads to bone density issues. So this article is hyperlinked for you right here. And estrogen plays a key role in that bone homeostasis. So does inflammation. So circulating inflammatory molecules will compromise the formation of new bone, and sometimes they'll kind of boost the resorption of bone, what's also called the remineralization, in a way that's not so good. Gut microbes also act on intestinal secretory cells, which affect the brain. And which in turn impacts calcium absorption and therefore bone formation. It's actually really a good idea at perimenopause to screen for parathyroid issues. I actually didn't know about the parathyroid for a really long time. I was very familiar with thyroid issues, which I have. And I have to take thyroid for medication for low thyroid, but the parathyroid can also be implicated. So it's along with bone density tests, it's a good baseline to get. And then gut microbiota influenced the transformation of the inactive form of thyroid hormone to its active form, which is T4. T4 promotes the cells called osteoblasts, which stimulate the formation of new bone. And they also influence the synthesis of estrogen, the secretion of estrogen, circulating estrogen, immune function, as we've said. So, what this means, and I think this is on the cutting edge of medicine, is that we know that we can take menopausal hormone therapy to increase circulating estrogen, but we can also influence the gut microbes and the microbiome to increase circulating estrogen, and to stimulate bone metabolism and all the other aspects of menopause, even brain health, which is related to estrogen in the brain. And as we've already seen, estrogen influences the diversity of the gut microbiome. In one study, the microbe Bacillus subtilis influences bone metabolism. And that, I believe, is something that will be able to be taken at some point in the near future. And again, this is a study that's sort of about to come out. But if you want to, you can read its preprint right now. And then I just wanted to kind of end with a few little tidbits. New studies in mice show that fecal transplantation, when you take the fecal matter from some mice and transplant it into the other, it's been shown to alleviate bone loss. So that's another potential new direction in regulating the bone loss that comes with menopause. So the takeaway really is that gut microbe diversity relates to infection, which is a major driver in menopause severity. It also relates to sleep quality, pulling that in from elsewhere, neuroinflammation, bone synthesis, and so much more. So I hope this has been helpful. You can click on this if you're interested in joining me on Saturday. We're doing a menopause lab, which will workshop the issues of the people that are with us and really go into detail in what you can be doing, even earlier than you think you need to. Again, I just want to say that I often hear people say, well, I'm only 32, so I can't be in perimenopause, or their doctors will tell them you can't be in perimenopause. But we already know that not to be true. And the earlier we address these issues, the better. All right, so I'm going to stop screen sharing. And we're pretty much at time. I see that there's a little comment in the chat. Oh, hi, June. I can take a question or two if there are any. I'm really happy to stay a moment and do that if it would be helpful. I realize that this is a lot of information and you may want to digest. But if you want to, you can either raise your hand and I'll see that, or you could type your question into the chat if you want, or if you want to just digest, that's fine as well. Hi, Carrie. Oh, you're working in the menopause space. Good for you. That's so cool. Thank you for the kind words. Oh, hi, Sharon. Breast health and lumps and density. I assume that you're talking about that in relation to Saturday. And yes, we can address that. There's actually some really important information on what to do if you have dense breasts and how to address that. I have that, and I've actually gotten some genetic testing, and I'm in that process. I'm always happy to share. Hi, Melissa. Oh, yeah, hypermobility. So, if you read the musculoskeletal syndrome article, you will find, I think that I think it kind of gives us a sense of why there's fascial pain, because we can go from being very loose jointed to being very unstable and having joint inflammation and an increase in collagen, which means more stiffness in a body that did not have that. So that is really key. I don't see raised hands, although there's a lot of you and it's hard to look through. Maybe go into the chat. Yeah, no raised hands so far. Yeah, so I hope this is helpful. Yeah, menopause, cognitive health, and endocrine conditions. Becky, if you look at the ADHD article on Substack, which we'll link here, I think you'll find it really helpful. It addresses ADHD, but it also goes into how estrogen is synthesized in the brain and how it affects particularly the dopamine synthesis and the prefrontal cortex. And yes, it is so challenging to find people that are interested in this. And that are also paying attention to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And there are things that we can do that are significant in this kind of period. And I think one of those is to, again, influence that first half of sleep where we get the glymphatic system kind of pumping through. I think that's it. Does anyone have a burning question? I guess I really just want to, with the most affection I hope you can feel, is to advocate for you, to give you the tools to advocate for yourself. Because if we don't do that early, we get in a place where it becomes a little harder. It's like a kind of Sisyphean task to reverse some of the things that happen. We still can do that, but that's not easy. So, okay, so a question in queue. Okay, thank you, Ingrid. If you can't make it Saturday, but you pay to have access, can we watch it at a different time? Yes. If you click on that picture, or actually it's going to be on the page where you get the replay to this, you definitely can watch asynchronously and you'll have 7 days. You can download the whole thing. So my recommendation is download on day one, You can keep it, you can keep the PowerPoint. I really want you to have everything that you possibly need. And I'm also preparing a symptom tracker for you to be able to track symptoms so that not only can you go to a provider and advocate for whatever form of treatment you want, particularly at a younger age, say if you're a survivor or if you have symptoms, but also so that you know what's working. Although providers can get estrogen levels, those most do not after the first level. And so they really tend to go by symptoms. And if you don't pay attention to what's happening with your symptoms, you're just unable to tell them that you might need more. I hope that's helpful. Yeah, and I know there's a lot going on right now, so we're designing this so that you can access that recording, download it, watch it as many times as you want. Look at the PowerPoint, take the symptom tracker, fill that out. And I know that's a lot of work, but in my experience and in so many of the people I work with, if you just go in with this vague idea or even a post-it with symptoms, it's not enough for your provider. You actually need to do the work for them. I know that sounds a little funky, but that's where we are now. I think the good providers are overwhelmed. So the more you're informed, I think the more empowerment you have in shaping your treatment and in knowing what's working. So you'll have to be able to say, this dose is too low, this dose feels too high, these are the symptoms that are better, these are the symptoms that. Particularly if you want to receive menopausal hormone therapy. I don't see anything else, so I think I'll sign off for now. But thank you all so much for being with me. I know that we have a long way to go in this area, and a generation of women have been left behind, and I want you not to be. There is a lot of encouraging indications that even if you're quote unquote past 60, which is seen right now as a cutoff age for menopausal hormone therapy, that you still might be able to get that, particularly if you're in good cardiovascular health. So, yeah, just really thinking about the social context in the US and elsewhere where patriarchy and healthcare and valuing women that have had children and not women that have not, and abortion access, which is really healthcare access, and medical racism, and all these different factors that we're dealing with. And I think being able to share information with one another is the way that we move through this period of time. And I think it will take probably at least 5 years for this field to change. So I am prepared to do all the things that will help you. Feel free to share this information liberally with anyone that you think might need it. So I'm thinking of all of you, particularly if you're in the US, as we're facing a very strange and disturbing election cycle. So Saturday is kind of my way of being with you before that happens. But so much love to all of you. Please bookmark the page that we link you to because we'll keep adding resources there as well as on Substack. And you can search Substack by menopause and get all the things. Thank you. I'll see you all soon. I'm sending much love at this time in history and just appreciating you all for coming. I know the subject, the topic is not easy and it brings up a lot for us. So here we go into creating together the new social context in which menopause is addressed. We are the pioneers, and yeah, I can't think of a bigger honor to share with you than that. So thank you all so much.